Thank you. Let's see, this is working okay, good. Oh, guys, I'm all very humbled to be here with you and certainly aware of a lot of suffering that people go through. I'm reminded of a passage in Matthew where Jesus steps off the boat and it says he has compassion for them and he healed their sick. And I'm just praying that Jesus does some healings. Like, we want to be healed, right? We are coming together praying that God will heal us. And I just thought I'd introduce myself a little bit. Thank you, Brian, for that introduction. I've been a member here for 22 years. And I want to show you a picture of my family. It looks like, okay, I've got the different slides. It's coming. I'm glad you're here because I can multitask and give you my Christmas card at the same time. Merry Christmas! All right, this is my husband I've been married to for 26 years and our four kids. Yes, a couple of them are adopted. Some people are kind of weird about how do I ask about that. But and I think really if you raise four kids, that alone qualifies you to do a talk on anxiety. Yes, but I also have studied it quite a bit. So, and have trained lots of therapists and have been thinking a lot about it. So I know there's a lot of suffering. In fact, I read a quote from Psychology Today that said the average high school kid today has the same amount of anxiety as the average psychiatric patient did in the 1950s, which made me kind of fantasize about just checking myself into a hospital if I'm stressed, right? Some of you are very aware of anxiety, but other people might not be aware of it, but you just do like repetitively stupid things sometimes, which we think of as a sign of anxiety too. Or sometimes people have physical symptoms of anxiety, right? Like digestive problems or immune problems, hormonal headaches, all kinds of things. And you know when you have like an assignment that's due and you've been procrastinating, like maybe you do today, right? And you have this thing in the back of your mind that you know you have to take care of, but you haven't done it because you were avoiding something. Can you feel the tension in your body that comes from having that thing that you're avoiding? A lot of times, anxiety is about avoidance. And so we're going to talk about three things that we commonly avoid and how to address these symptoms. And of course, this is not an exhaustive list. I'm convinced there's 7.8 billion different problem sets in the world because that's how many people there are. Everybody's so different. But hopefully this will help you think of a lot of questions and get you thinking and talking to each other so we can really seek God for healing. Okay, one thing, this is the answer Jesus gives, one thing that we like to avoid is risk and uncertainty. Okay, so if you have this kind of anxiety that we call anticipatory anxiety, it's what we have when we worry about bad things happening and then we automatically figure out how we can avoid that, right? You may obsess about something that you said because someone might think you're stupid and you'd like to avoid that. Or you may like lay awake at night thinking about your son. He might have anxiety and you'd like to avoid that, right? You might get nervous because when your husband drives, he's a little reckless and you'd like to avoid an accident. There are lots of things that are uncontrollable too. So even if you do the right thing to avoid the bad outcome, you still can't control the outcome. This makes things even more uncertain. So all of us are aware of uncertainties, but some people are more aware than others. And they deal with that hypervigilance by trying to avoid the bad outcome. The problem is that uncertainty and risk is unavoidable. So your brain is trying to accomplish the impossible task of finding certainty. And the harder we try to find guarantees, the more anxious we get. We do have plenty of reasons to fear, right? My daughter, who just got married, I should do that picture of her wedding. When she started dating Edison, things were pretty good. We felt pretty good about it. They would like date in our kitchen because they were 18 and 19 at the time. They were there a lot. And we enjoyed hanging out with them. We grew to trust him and we had a great time. Then they started getting more serious. We started hearing things about marriage. And like I said, they were 18. And then, so we asked our older friends about this, if we should, you know, if they had any advice for us. Well, they had a bad experience with their adult child, so you can imagine the advice and the warnings that start coming. All of a sudden, things were not very predictable in my mind. And not only were they uncertain, but they were uncontrollable. And my brain could only think of all of the bad things that could happen. I could not sleep imagining Maya getting trapped in this relationship for the rest of her life and ruining our family, right? After a day or two, I was like totally convinced of her doom. Sorry, Edison. Surprisingly, the next time he came over, he looked rather innocent. I was like, oh, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, well, my avoidance of this possible bad outcome, though, had already had an effect. So on Maya, she was alarmed and very hurt that we were suddenly so hesitant. And it resulted in months of defensiveness and reassurance and difficult conversations. We recovered, and I'm very happy that my daughter has a wonderful, caring husband who I trust completely with our most precious treasure. But this is an example of this kind of anxiety. So what do we do about this? Well, there are some things that make it worse, like denial or minimizing or kind of rationalizing things. You may have a husband or a friend who tries to kind of make you feel better by downplaying the risk. If my husband at 2 o'clock in the morning when I was freaking out had said to me, "I'm sure they'll be fine, honey, go to bed," it wouldn't have helped, right? Without really considering the issue. Another thing that's not very helpful is shame or frustration with our anxiety. There's 365 verses in the Bible about fear. My daughter says this because she has studied it. And sometimes we think about those verses like God's kind of resentful. Like, fear not, you stupid, I've got this, right? It's nothing to be concerned about. But I want to show you an example of a verse where Jesus is responding to someone who's full of fear, and it does not look like that. Okay, so this verse comes from Revelations. This is where John is seeing a vision of Jesus. It says, "The hair on his head was white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire. His feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. In his right hand he held 7 stars, and coming out of his mouth was a sharp double-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in all its brilliance. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead." Can you blame him? I mean, nobody would blame this guy for being afraid, right? I tried to find some art to visualize this, but they are all incredibly silly. Look at this. Like, there's clearly no way you can draw this thing. Now, that, I don't know if you can see in his hand the stars, but you can kind of see. That is not what stars look like. Do you remember a couple weeks ago, Bill gave this sermon, and he showed these pictures of these stars that hold, like, millions of Earths? So can you imagine how big Jesus would have had to have been to hold 7 stars? There's nothing. We can't imagine anything like this. And a voice like Niagara Falls. Anyway, so the remedy of Jesus in dealing with John's like overwhelming fear, right, is not to deny the danger. Clearly, this is the most dangerous place to be. But the next verse, Revelations 1:17, says, where did that go? I won't read about it. Let me just read it to you. "He placed his right hand on me and said, 'Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead. And look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys to death and Hades.'" Okay, I have to admit that even though I'm saved, and I know that this life is temporary and God is really big, thank you for the verse, I have to admit that when I'm like laying awake worrying about my daughter's future, knowing that Jesus holds these keys and whatnot is not very relevant to me. But I think that's just because we are so disconnected from the image, from Jesus' actual presence, his actual presence. It's very hard for us to imagine what this is looking like. So let's go back to that picture for a second. First, Jesus touches John with his right hand. Okay, remember, he was holding 7 stars. I think that constitutes having your hands full. So he would be like, "John!" dropping stars all over the place, right? And he touches them. And then he talks in that voice that's like Niagara Falls kind of voice. And then he tells him, "Look, there's something that Jesus is doing here that we can do, we can repeat when we are anxious." So I want to introduce you to an important part of the brain for a second that we're going to talk about here. It is called the insular cortex, or the insula. we can call it. It's deep in the brain. It's connected to the brainstem. It connects to all kinds of other parts of your brain. And it takes in sensory input. And so it gets the sensory input before it gets logical information. It feels emotions before you think about things. So now John, in this Bible verse, would feel Jesus' hand on his shoulder and look at him. This kind of grounding is a critical skill that you need to manage anxiety. But also I want you to see how compassionate this is of Jesus. When you see someone who's scared, who's like, they're small and hurting and you feel like touching them, what's the emotion you're feeling? Compassion, right? Yes. So the insula is the part of the brain that produces compassion. We can look at a person, we can see their suffering, we can want to improve it. And when we experience compassion with another person, it totally changes the anticipated suffering. Instead of seeing danger, you see safety and closeness. And with Jesus, we see someone who also knows the future. When you are anxious and you begin dreading outcomes, you need to open your eyes. When you're trying to hide, you actually need to look and see what's going on. You need to experience somebody's compassion. With Maya and my worries about her, I needed more information, not less. There's another verse that tells us about the miraculous power of compassion. And think of compassion as a more concrete way of describing the feeling of love. Okay, so this verse says, "There is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear." Okay, this is a really big verse. Like, if we're trying to get rid of anxiety, we need to know about perfect love. Right? Because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. So this verse specifically is talking about you don't have to fear punishment on judgment day if you have God living in you. It's a great chapter to study if you want to know more about love. But it also relates to anxiety because we can see from neuroscience that this is literally true. So when you feel compassion for yourself, remember I told you about that insula, it triggers the brain to produce oxytocin, dopamine, and serotonin, which when oxytocin increases, then cortisol goes down. Cortisol is the body's primary stress hormone. So this is a good hormone. You need it to stay awake or you'd all be sleeping. But if you get too much, too often, it can be a problem because it slows down all the other systems in your body. Your immune system, digestion, reproduction, all of that just stops working. So this is a study here that shows measured cortisol in stressful situations. So the red line shows how cortisol increases after a stressful situation and then decreases slowly, but you can see how even after like 90 minutes, it's not all the way back to normal. But look at the yellow line. So this measures how much cortisol increases during the same stressor if the person has a support person and some oxytocin nasal spray. Do you see how when the oxytocin is there, the cortisol goes down? And I think that's like when perfect love is there, it casts out fear. Isn't that cool? So I made this little acronym. I kind of like acronyms to help you remember some tips of dealing with this type of anxiety. And I used that verse, fear not, to help you remember. So F stands for feel. And I literally mean feel with your senses. You can take your shoes off and feel the grass. You can smell something, you can feel your arm or something cold, but getting your body in the present moment feeling something is really critical. E stands for exhale. If you put your hand on your stomach and you push all the air out, like that, and you take a big breath and you push it out again, and you do that like 3 times, you'll start to get lightheaded. And that's because you have more oxygen in your bloodstream, your heart is slowing down, your mind is slowing down, and you would pass out if you kept doing it like 5 times. So that tells you your blood chemistry is changing. If you just do that exhaling, it changes the panic attack that could be coming. It's pretty amazing. A is for ask questions. Remember how I said you need more information, not less. Our anxiety tells us, avoid the bad outcome, hide, don't let it happen. What we want to do is ask questions, look for more information. What is it that I'm afraid of in particular? There is a reason. You may not be aware of the reason, but if you allow yourself to ask, there's something that your brain is worried about. What's the worst that could happen? Look for signs of what's really going on. Okay, ask questions. R stands for ready, because some people's anxiety is so bad that they cannot stop avoiding the outcome unless they prepare for it. So if this is you and you just like to be prepared, go ahead, just like write the eulogy, get ready for your funeral so that you can drive on the freeway, right? It works for some people. And not stands for notice compassion. So this is what I'm talking about. Notice either you can pay attention to Jesus' compassion for you. You can have compassion for somebody else, which totally gets your brain going in a different direction. Or it tells somebody about what you're experiencing so you get their compassion. Okay, another thing that we avoid that causes anxiety is emotion. In particular, conflicting emotions. Okay, now conflicting emotions are a sign of maturity. We like that. We like to have like my needs and your needs, they may conflict and we can hold them both, right? We may have like feelings that are good and bad about a lot of different situations. But repressed conflict creates a lot of tension in the body and anxiety-driven behaviors. So specifically, I want to talk about sadness. This is my picture of, Kai told me he looks like a Simon, so I'm calling him a Simon. He's sad and lonely because his wife in the background, you can see, is unhappy with him. And this is in direct opposition to how he thinks he's supposed to feel, right? He doesn't want to tell her about his sadness, about the disconnection, because he doesn't want to feel weak. And it might give her a chance to just tell him how it's all his fault. And so instead of dealing with this tension in himself, he is tempted to just kind of change the subject, move on, make it better, and maybe he'll go get a drink or something, or turn on the TV, or just get some consumed on his phone. This would be called numbing. It's normal because we don't like these difficult experiences like sadness, but the Bible proposes a different solution. It says, now if any of you lacks wisdom, and the previous verses are talking about trouble, like dealing with trouble. And James says, if you lack wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault. Oh, I just love that verse. So the reason that we can go to God is because he is generous and doesn't find fault. It may have been all your fault that your wife was unhappy, probably. And you can go to God and he's not going to tell you it's all your fault. I think this is so great. He'll give you all this wisdom, right? We can confidently go to God acknowledging the suffering. I'm sad. I'm lonely. This is hurting me. This is hard. And then when you wait, when you stay in that for just a little bit longer, you strengthen your ability to handle sadness and loneliness. And God will give you wisdom and comfort. Or picture a high school girl or boy. We have some high schoolers here, I think. And you thought you had some friends, and now all of a sudden, they're not your friends. They've connected with somebody else, and now you don't have anybody, and you don't have a group, and nobody seems to understand you. You wouldn't be missed if you're not at school. And that is so sad, and it happens to everybody. Every teenager experiences this. The thing is, that sadness, that loneliness won't kill you. You can get through it. But the avoidance of it will cause some damage. Everyone feels things like that. Or imagine a mother who's very frustrated with her kids because they're not listening. And then she feels some, like, frustration, it's not working, and maybe some guilt because she's been doing this ineffective parenting, maybe some fear because she's afraid she's going to mess them up. She could possibly forget about all this because she has so much to do, by getting herself distracted, but her body will not forget. Because the sympathetic nervous system responds to the threat of loss by releasing cortisol, this repressed conflict creates all kinds of tension in the body. And numbing makes it worse. Okay, what makes it worse? Numbing. When we face conflicting feelings, we have two options, basically. We can avoid them, which will lead to anxiety, I'm telling you, a heart attack eventually. Or we can seek wisdom, which is led by compassion. Okay, there's one type of wisdom that is always necessary. There's lots of different wisdom for different situations that will be different in every time. But this is always important, okay? And it's thankfully is wired into your brain. You already have it. You just may not be totally aware of it. Remember, I told you about the insula. I'm going to bring up a picture again because it's so important. It's complicated brain science, so I have to simplify it. So some of the things aren't exactly accurate, but you'll get the concept. When we talk about the heart, like loving God with all your heart or loving each other, we're actually talking about the thing that happens, we think, in this part of the brain, this insular cortex and cingulate cortex. It takes sensations from your body, like I told you, feeling from auditory, visual stimulation, and it turns that data up in the front of this part into an emotion like love or disgust. It then sends signals to your prefrontal cortex, and you think about it, and back to your body, and it produces like warmth and eye movement and smiles and reaching out or a desire to vomit, depending on which thing you're looking at. So this is where compassion comes from. Let's talk a little more about compassion. What's compassion? Compassion is the feeling that arises when you are confronted with another's suffering and you feel motivated to relieve that suffering. So it's not that you're actually able to fix it. A lot of times we're not able to relieve the suffering. And sometimes it's not even better. But the important part is that you are motivated to relieve it. You feel a desire. That's caring. And another way of thinking about suffering is just kind of like vulnerability, because we're all essentially suffering in some way. So when we feel conflicting feelings, back to our lonely Simon there, and we look at someone with compassion, it causes a series of reactions. I told you about the increased oxytocin and dopamine and serotonin and decreased cortisol. We get a lot wiser and we are unstuck. This is actually what the Bible says about how powerful it is. Which compassion is the way I'm concretely describing love, okay? It says love covers over a multitude of sins. Now that's amazing to have like magic eraser. I love that magic eraser. That's a magic eraser of sins. Perfect love casts out fear. It fulfills the law of Christ. It endures all things. It binds everything together, and your joy will be full. Now, there is no magical thing like cures and stuff for anxiety, but this is amazing. If that's what the Bible says about love, that is a really powerful skill, tool, whatever you want to call it. We need to develop this, right? So what gets in the way? One thing that gets in the way is our contempt for weakness, because nobody actually likes vulnerability. We don't really want to be suffering and share it with anybody. So I'll just share you one verse with you. Hebrews 5:2 says, he is able to deal gently with those who are ignorant and are going astray because he himself is subject to weakness. Okay, if you need any argument for allowing yourself to feel weakness, it's this. Jesus did himself and you're not stronger than Jesus. Okay. The other thing that I think gets in the way is busyness or task mode. So I grew up in the Midwest where being a Christian meant you go to church on Sunday and you work hard. That's just what it meant. My grandma would say, oh, there's a new neighbor. I'm sure they're Christian. He just works so hard. And so I've always worked hard. My grandparents are farmers. My parents are. We just always work hard. I'm sure I always will. And now that I have a family, almost everything I do is working hard for them. And it's because I care and want to serve them and love them, but guess what? Sometimes that task focus, even though it's motivated out of love that I'm doing these things, that working towards a goal can very easily consume me, and it engages a competitive part in us. Okay, so even if we're like unselfishly wanting to do something, but then we're so focused on doing that thing, do you remember how I said compassion motivates you to relieve the suffering of someone else? Competitiveness is focused on winning and getting people to join your goal. And so they're kind of opposed. So like here's an example. There's currently 5 people living in our house right now since Maya has got married. And we all have different schools, 3 different schools. I know it's maybe foolish, but that's how it is. And we have 2 different jobs. And we all need to be out of the house by 7:30. So that's a lot of lunches to pack, keys not to lose, and teeth to brush, right? Last week, I was in a typical get-out-the-door mode, and because we've got to get Kai, my youngest, to the bus on time. And I sent him to his room to get something quickly, his coat or something, which is a mistake because he's not quick. He's the most distracted person in the family. And so I was waiting by the door, getting more and more anxious by the second and frustrated because I knew he wouldn't hurry. And then he comes up and he still needs his shoes. But Luna is our most compassionate member of the family. And she's always so kind to bring you a shoe when you come in, but she often misplaces shoes around the house. So here was Kai. We could still not find his shoes. And I was irritated. I blamed him. Like, "You're not listening." And he looked very sadly at me and he says, "Mom, I didn't mean to make you mad. I just had to brush my teeth too." I wasn't really mad. I was just hurried, right? And working towards a goal. But the Bible says that's the wrong goal, right? Even though we've got to get to the bus, that's the wrong goal. Look at this verse. 1 Corinthians 13 says, "If I have prophetic powers, which I do not, and I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have faith to move mountains and get to the bus on time," sorry, just a second, didn't say that, "but have not love, I am nothing," right? At some point, I needed to look at my son that morning and remember who he is and remember that I like him and enjoy each other. We might still have been frustrated that we couldn't find the shoes, but you can see how differently things would have gone and how different he would have felt leaving the house that day. And I know, I don't know exactly how it looks. Some of you might be thinking, like, how do you get to the bus on time if you're not pressuring people and you're just standing around gazing at each other? I don't know exactly, but I know that in this state of compassion, you are using your whole brain. And with your whole brain connected, you are 100% better at making decisions and communicating and getting things done. So let's try a little experiment for a second. I'd like you to identify a partner. If you're like the odd person in a row, it's fine. You can just use your imagination, but just kind of identify that you're with a partner, who that partner's gonna be. And I want you to think for a second about when you go home tonight, you probably have a lot to do. Or you probably have something on your agenda. It's Monday tomorrow, you might have work, you might have forgotten an email, you might have an assignment to do, you might have some lunches to pack, and you want to get the kids to bed on time, and right? Okay, can you feel the pressure rising a little bit? But before you run anxiously out the door to do all your stuff, I want you to shift gears for a second and think about your partner right next to you. Think about something that you appreciate about that person. Okay, and if you don't know them, you can just kind of think about their position in life and imagine some of the challenges they might face. And now look at them. Like, really look at them. Thinking about that, we care about this person that's next to us, right? Okay, I see lots of good smiles. This is what we like to feel all the time. This is what God created us to feel. Is that joy of caring and being cared for all the time. And you can imagine, if you experience this more and more, the more you do, it increases joy. It literally changes all of your interactions and protects against anxiety. That's what we're going for. One other thing that gets in the way of experiencing compassion, and also the third source of anxiety I'm going to cover tonight, is avoiding trauma. So it is kind of a bummer to move to this topic after that nice, fuzzy, warm feeling. But we're going to go for it. Get done here pretty soon. So trauma is the lasting emotional response that often results from living through a distressing event. I'm going to show you this map here, shows you in the world which countries have the highest amount of trauma. In the U.S., 84% of people have lived through at least one traumatic event. So when a person has been exposed to a threat that has flooded their brain with emotion that's really unregulated, or maybe repeated over time, we experience trauma. And the brain will do interesting things to try to avoid a trauma that's already happened. We don't fully understand it even, but it can result in a very repetitive sort of the brain trying to overcome trauma, and it produces a lot of suffering. Here's another problem related to trauma. Okay, so I've got their repetitive thoughts cause a lot of suffering. Another problem related to trauma is that our brains, they have this ability to map another person's mind, to figure out what they're thinking and feeling. You're doing it right now. You're thinking about what I'm thinking, trying to figure it out. Or maybe you're thinking about your neighbor's thoughts and how this is affecting them. Or maybe you're like taking in all this information and relating it to the map that you have of your own mind, right? So we're constantly doing this, and we're quite proficient at it, actually, since the age of 4. But if what your mind encounters in someone else is so terrible for you to comprehend, for instance, like if someone wanted to hurt you or chose to deliberately ignore you, our brains will oftentimes choose to ignore that information and maintain ambiguity rather than be honest about what it sees in another person's brain, especially if it was a loved one, right? And this kind of dishonesty within ourselves creates a ton of anxiety. David Sharsh calls this traumatic mind mapping. It makes your brain very vulnerable to incorrectly mapping out other people too, where you see them as the enemy, even though they may not be. So if we go back to that insular cortex, remember, compassion is created and felt in the insula, but so is disgust. So what we're designed to feel when we see somebody hurting or vulnerable or suffering, we're designed to feel compassion, right? We want to relieve their suffering. And then when we see somebody else wanting to hurt a vulnerable individual, like a psychopath, you know, that enjoys murder, we are designed to feel disgust, right? This is really gross. That is something we hate. But it is not good for our brains to get repeated disgust triggered over and over in it. We can become overwhelmed by that disgust. The insula sort of just takes over and stops communicating with the prefrontal cortex. Or in some cases, you lose your sensitivity and your ability to feel. We know this intuitively, like if you feed a baby a new food, oftentimes they're disgusted by it, out it comes, right? But after you repeat this several times, they will get used to it and they will tolerate it and they lose their disgust reaction. Oftentimes, this is how people who have been sexually abused or dealt with domestic violence, who would normally be repulsed by victimization, have gotten used to it or even expect it. And sometimes we get tricked when we are supposed to feel disgust. When you're a child, you don't really know any different. So sometimes children will grow up in households where they're being treated poorly, but everyone acts like this is normal. You might have had an alcoholic parent who knew that it would have an effect on you when they chose to get drunk over and over, but they did it anyway. Or they might have laughed at your distress. This is also one of the problems in a long line of problems of pornography, right? Most of us know that the pornography industry is not the most admirable, right? It is essentially using somebody who's vulnerable, using their vulnerability, taking advantage of them, and enjoying harm. We know what is going on, yet we can become aroused by it. And this is very difficult for the brain to reconcile, unless you have antisocial tendencies, which is another problem. But for most of you, that's not the case, so it will just make you anxious. It will also make it hard to feel love and compassion. Remember, the disgust and compassion come from the same part of the brain. And we don't want to repress or damage those neural connections. We want them to grow in order to feel love. The good news is that science and the Bible tell us that the brain can heal. But for people who have suffered the consequences of other people's disgusting behavior towards them, they are carrying a really large burden. It is going to take a lot of compassion to help them shoulder it. So what makes it worse, what makes the results of trauma worse, I think one of the things, is minimization. Think of the last time someone asked you how you were doing and you told them this something hard maybe, but then you're like, but it's okay. I mean, I shouldn't complain. A lot of people have it worse, right? You ever find yourself saying that? Now, it is possible that sometimes what you're going through is so hard that you can't bear to share those feelings, and that's totally respectable. It's not always safe. But if you don't share it somewhere, it will come back to haunt you, or you'll have a heart attack. But some people share things like that. They minimize trauma or things that have happened to them because they feel like it's more holy, sort of, or courageous or strong. And I just want to respectfully disagree with you. It's not. Jeremiah 6 in Jeremiah, he is confronting Jerusalem very harshly. Here he says, therefore, I will give their wives to other men and their fields to new owners. From the least to the greatest, all are greedy for gain. Prophets and priests alike all practice deceit. They dress the wound of my people as though it were not serious. Peace, peace, they say, when there is no peace. And oftentimes we as Christians do this because we think we're supposed to be grateful, and we are, but that minimizing trauma or what has happened to people or ourselves is not helpful. It's like a lie. It's saying something that is bad and calling it good or okay. And we know God wouldn't see our suffering like that. He doesn't say, it's okay that happened to you. Stop your crying, right? That would be cold-hearted, and we know God's not like that, but sometimes we're like that to ourselves. I also want to just add, sometimes people are afraid that you couldn't, like, forgive someone if you really confront what really happened. I think it's totally the opposite. We don't forgive by making excuses for people. We forgive. Forgiveness means that you release them of the punishment that they deserve. Right? That's what the gospel is. It's not saying that we are really that good. We are released of the punishment that we actually deserve. So you can forgive even while you feel disgust for what somebody's done. David was a great example of somebody who experienced trauma like Saul did, but did not have the same PTSD symptoms like Saul did. He didn't minimize. He trusted God's compassion. He faced the feelings. He said, have mercy on me, my God. Have mercy on me, for in you I take refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. We can see lots of references to God's moving love, offering comfort and safety, and somehow God gives us this experience of holding, and the holding relaxes us and relieves the anxiety of repetitive thoughts. David was able to believe this, and even though it does appear he had some repetitive thoughts too, he trusted in God's unfailing love and experienced, and that brought him joy. We can see David relying on the Lord's compassion and friendship. We see Saul, on the other hand, numbing, turning pain into aggression, and eventually killing himself. This is a precarious place for the traumatized person. And remember, there's a lot of traumatized people in our churches. So we have to do a lot better at having compassion for each other, at providing another person to carry the weight of what somebody's endured. But we have a promise. Do you remember that love covers over a multitude of sins? That's what it does. God provided a way out of this. He redeems it. So I'm excited for you guys to talk about this. I have some discussion questions here. Now, a lot of people get really anxious in social situations too. And discussion groups make people really anxious. And so I just want to say we're going to practice two things, okay? There's two possibilities for you in a discussion group. You are either caring and feeling compassion for the person who's talking, and you let yourself look at them, and you think about what they're saying, you notice where they're suffering, and you feel a desire to relieve it. It doesn't matter that you don't have the answer. You just need to feel the desire and communicate that desire. Or you're the person who's being cared for. So if you're talking, you can expect that people are caring about what you're saying. Okay, so that's what these discussion questions are designed to promote, is that in your group of four or five, you will take some turns, get caring for each other. And then that'll be the end of our time. Thank you, guys.